This episode of Truth's Table is brought to you by Truth's Table Presents, the Faith and Child Anti-Poverty Forum. Please consider joining us on April the 4th in Columbia, Maryland at the Harriet Tubman Cultural Center. We're going to be tackling the important topic of ending child poverty in the United States. To get your free ticket, go to Eventbrite and look up Truth's Table, Faith and Child Anti-Poverty Forum. We can't wait to see you there.
Sisters, how y'all feel? Brothers, y'all all right? If this is your first time at Truth's Table, welcome to the table. And if you've been sitting at the table with us all these years, we are so grateful that you have been listening to us through these years, and we are inviting you to partner with us and support our work at patreon.com/truthstable. Now pull up a chair and have a seat at the table with us. Hey y'all, welcome to Truth's Table, Midwives and Culture for Grace and Truth. I'm McKemini.
And I'm Christina.
This table is built by Black women and for Black women. So welcome to the table, C. How you doing, girl?
You know, I'm doing okay today. How are you doing today?
A little tired, but we're going to keep moving.
This is a theme that people will know that we are at the recording retreat because fatigue is a theme of the recording retreat now. Although we have just eaten lunch, and so that's a blessing. I do believe that should help with clarity of thought because we have a serious topic on the table that deserves clarity of thought.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, yes. So, yeah, we are talking about, child poverty and, you know, just our own understanding, you know, of poverty, how we came to form ideas about that, either through the church, through culture, through people we know, our own experience. So that is what is on the table, you know. So
let's talk about money.
What's going on? How would you like to launch? I'm thinking like how you know, what was your, I guess, your own, I guess, growing up, your own relationship to money, or even now, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, how were you shaped and formed? You know, how did you come to an understanding of how you conceptualize, think about money, and use money today?
Yeah, I mean, I may have some unusual opinions about money in the sense that I don't like what the fear of not having money and the lust of money does to people. Like I have a particular sensitivity, like an acute sensitivity to the way I see people flip out over money. And with that being said, not because like we don't need it, like we got to eat, like we need to have lights on. It's important. Yeah. But I think there's a couple, there seems to be like a couple of things that make people, you know, just cut up. That is at the top of the list.
Oh, for sure.
It is money. I mean, there's a proverb that talks about asking the Lord to not give us much that we forget the Lord. And then the second part of that text is, the second part of that text is to not have so little that we're tempted to dishonor God to get it, right? And so that speaks to just people's temptations, I think, around money and when we and who we think is caring for us and keeping us and what we have to meet our needs, right? So I think one of my earliest traumatic memories is about money. If I go back in my mind and think about what is my most earliest traumatic memory, it is definitely about human depravity and lust for money, even over the most smallest amount, what people feel like they have a right to have. And so it has shaped me in some ways that probably make me a certain type of businesswoman because I cringe a little bit when it's all about the dollars because I've literally seen someone's life threatened over $5. That's one of my earliest memories. And so I just know visually when people freak out and feel like I don't have what I'm supposed to have, then where it can drive someone, right? And also how wicked it is to create the systems and ecosystems that foster that type of desperation.
Yeah.
But also the ways in which we can start to live in a way that's so prideful that we think that our worth and value is defined by a dollar amount. So, yeah, so that's a bit about me in that whole hodgepodge. But how about you? Kind of your relationship to money in terms of your earliest memories or your understanding of money and poverty.
Growing up, you know, I didn't come with a family from a family of means. We didn't have money like that. You know, my mom functionally was a single mom, and we grew up in low-income housing, aka the projects. They were nice for where we were, but that's the reality of where I lived and where I grew up. And I remember one of my earliest memories is I remember the stigma, the shame, and the indignity, right, and inhumanity attached to that. To sure. Living where we lived, you know.
So much shame around poverty.
Yeah, so much. And I remember it was elementary school. You know, elementary school. Can't remember. Elementary, middle, let's say fourth, fifth grade, somewhere there. You know, and I remember this one guy at our school saying, like, oh, all the people that live there, over there. Mm-hmm. You know, are poor. This was a little Filipino boy, too, mm-hmm. by the way. mm-hmm. You know, all the people that live over there, I think my mom says, or whatever, you know, are welfare or food stamps or, you know, all types of whatever, you know, whatever that was supposed to mean.
They need governmental assistance.
governmental assistance. All
right,
that.
Right.
You know, and so all this the
but,
shame.
But it's a caricature. It's a caricature because
it wasn't support. True that everybody there that, yeah. you know,
and even was if they that. Did, that wouldn't
and
even
so
that.
What? even if, people. You know, that has no bearing on, you know, who they are as, mm-hmm. you know, image bearers, you know, or who we are as image bearers. And so I remember that. And, you know, you just begin to figure out, you know, where you are on the class totem pole and the race class totem pole, right. you know, as well, when you are among your peers, you know, in school and growing up, and then you see things going like, oh yeah, all of us do live particularly here. You know, all the Black people seem to somehow be situated here.
Sure.
And then our white counterparts don't live here. And they don't come around here. You know,
when you're young, you don't know about redlining or the social and historical dynamics.
The structural, exactly. You don't know about the structural, you know, systems that keep you where you live and keep the others out, you know, which is all by design. So that was probably my earliest memory in that. Okay. I mean, I knew we didn't have money, but we had everything that we needed, though. We definitely had everything we needed. Yeah. Never missed a meal. It was never, we weren't hanging in the chat line. You know what I'm saying? I
mean, yeah.
You know,
that's just, because there are levels.
There's levels to it. Yeah, so, you know, I don't want to, you know, because I think that you could overstate it, you know, but you could also understate it. Yeah. You know, so I think that's a fair, you know, assessment. But my mom did always emphasize the importance of being good stewards over whatever you got, the little bit you got. And, you know, she would write her checks, kind of her checkbook. And, you know, just so she was pretty wise, you know, with money. She never had a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why she really had to manage it, because she was the one that had to take care of the family. She was the breadwinner for all of us. And so and she worked a lot. She worked a whole lot. And I think that's also part of what it means to have an understanding, you know, of having little means or being on borderline poverty or just, you know, low income, is that your parents or your parent, you know, is working all the time.
For sure.
And so, and one of the consequences of that is you having to, you know, you're at that point, latchkey kids were a thing.
Yeah.
And I was absolutely in a number.
For sure.
You know, and so, yeah, because you had to take care of yourself because you didn't have the financial capacity and the means to have, you know, my mom didn't have the financial means or capacity to just hire some babysitter. And also, you don't want to have your kids with just any old body. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think about that. But she did try to instill some good, you know, principles with me and my siblings about, you know, at least taking care of our money. Mm-hmm. And I'd say we all kind of are pretty good about trying to at least take care. So yeah, we had a, you know, a pretty basic, you know, level, you know, understanding of like stewarding your money well. Mm-hmm. I think when you don't have a lot of it, you try to, you know, also I know it can go either way, you know, for people, you know, if you don't have much of it, then you just go ahead and spend it. I know that some people live on that street. When you don't have a lot of it, you try to, you know, be as wise with it as you can. And so I think that's something that me and my siblings, you know, got the latter is what we got, you know, from our mom, which I'm grateful for. But I also just think that, you know, because I just didn't have a lot of it, I think I can even see how it impacts me even now, you know, to some degree. You know, I think there's still some of that, if I'm honest, like some poverty mentality. So where it's like, well, if I, mm-hmm. let me try to make this thing work. mm-hmm. All right, I'll try to hold on to stuff until it's like, until it falls off, you know, because I'm like, well, I don't need to buy. Do I really need to buy a new one of whatever this is? And I think there is some of that, you know, in play. I think that's probably ingrained from childhood, if I'm just honest about that. But I also think it is also part of what it means to also be entrepreneurial, right? Because you don't have a check every 2 weeks, right? So you're always trying to manage what you got when you get it and just trying to be wise about, at least for me, I'm trying to be wise about, okay, how do I manage this? Make it stretch and make it work. But then I also, you know, I also have, you know, a family member who, like you witness, you know, to their own detriment, you know, this lust for money, you know, a love, which obviously the scripture talks about in First Timothy 6:10 talks about, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, you know? And so I had an uncle, one of my favorite uncles, you know, who was living a trifle life, let's say it that way. And unfortunately was murdered, you know, because of, you know, because this is a love of money that causes and drives us, you know, toward, it's also systemic factors too. So I'm not trying to, you know, negate that too, but there's ways in which we can be tempted. We don't have enough of it. Just like Proverbs 30 says, you know, when we don't have enough of it, we can get very creative about the ways that we can get ill-gotten money.
Yeah.
You know, and unfortunately he was murdered, you know, because of the life that he was living. And, you know, and so, and the choices that were made and the ways that he made, let me say the ways that he made his money, you know, this was our money man, uncle, you know, when he came to the family parties, we all lined up because he was a rubber band man. He had money. So, and he would dole out money to all of us, you know? And so, and there's a lot of kids at the African parties. Okay. And so he had money. And so I just remember kind of just seeing, you know, different levels, you know, and just of how people enter in, you know, into this whole money world and poverty and
whatnot. Well, and some people's ill-gotten means are criminal in the social context, and some people's ill-gotten means because they have power,
corporate,
and they are able to whoever has the power dictates the morality of the laws of the land, and so you know, pharmaceutical companies putting out opioids that devastate lives that we know people are addicted to. There's still there's the same moral ramifications as somebody who is a street pharmacist, right?
Right.
But one of those has the protection of affluence and the other one doesn't. So, you know,
and the law.
I mean, I think in my mind, I make a distinction between, although they certainly overlap, between the way I think about my work ethic and the way I think about money. Those are two different, those are almost two different things for me. Like, I will always work. I will be surprised if I don't work. And you know how I am. I'm like, I don't pass up, you know, I have to give a lot of thought and discernment to passing up a job or being like, I don't think this is a fit. I'm like, it's a job. Like the way I think about work is you get it done.
Right.
You get it done for your family. And that's a value that, you know, that is instilled in me. Like, there are some things that I'm like, yeah, I feel like I'm not in an elitist way, but in a sense of like, yeah, I'm more qualified than this. This doesn't fit my life vision, but I'm going to do it. Until I get to the thing I want to do. So that's not necessarily stemming solely from a desperation just to be paid, but to be a good steward of what I know my money has to care for.
Yeah,
so that's the way
I've been entrusted with.
Yeah, that's the way I think that's the way I think about work. That's the way I think about how we use money, is that it is meant to be spent. And I don't mean that in a reckless way, but like, you know, when you think about the parable of, you know, the man who is hoarding all of these things, and it's like tonight your life
will be demanded of you.
Yes, will be required of you, and none of this stuff is going with you. And so I often think about the things that define me have to be the things that are eternal. They will be ultimately eternal. I think for me there's a contrast between that. And I think I was listening to your point about, you know, kids in school mm-hmm. recognizing very mm-hmm. early a social yep. kind of economic hierarchy. Yep. And I would say I've experienced that all my life, even to now, because when I tell people where I was born and raised, I get wildest yeah. responses from people that, you know, if I tell people that I was raised in Baltimore, even people who would say that they are conscious and that they do political work.
Taking it back with that.
Oh yeah. And they're justice minded and they know all about the stereotypes. I would say more often than mm-hmm. not, to the tune of mm-hmm. 90%. And I don't mm-hmm. care how enlightened they think they are, I get the most outrageous responses from people.
Oh, I'm sure.
Who think they know the city. Right. Who think they know it because they watch The Wire or whatever. But that has, because that's always been a part of my life since leaving Baltimore to go to college. It has been something that has always stood out
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, makes sense. Yep.
And it is a part of, what I think of it, honestly, I have real strong words about it, kind of a wickedness mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In the way that we caricature people, we demean people and dehumanize people. And I have seen people do that as it relates to Baltimore, as it relates to Chicago, as it relates to Compton. And it's particularly piercing when it's people that are of my same ethnic background mm-hmm, who mm-hmm. who do that. Mm-hmm. It's disturbing, but you can see the ways in which all of that has been internalized, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. And so as a person who doesn't have shame from where I was born and raised at all, yeah, yeah. like I don't have any shame yeah. about where I was born and raised, that is another reminder of just how people are defined by what they think something is mm-hmm, and how they mm-hmm. need this kind of external validation.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, for me, people are always surprised when I say I'm from California. And from the Bay Area particularly, but obviously if I say the Bay Area, they assume Oakland. I'm not from Oakland. I'm from Silicon Valley, so like San Jose area, mm-hmm. live right down the street from Apple. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, but we didn't have money. So
Apple didn't give us any of their money. We didn't
have money. Be clear on that. You know what I mean? But I was like, y'all know every city, just about every city does have low income housing. You
right.
know that.
Right. Because it has low income people.
Yeah. You know, and so people are always surprised because they always think I'm from, you know, the East Coast, which I get. I mean, I've been on the East Coast for a long time. And mm-hmm. I did grow up in the golden age of hip hop. And so very mm-hmm. deeply shaped by yeah. East Coast hip hop. So I think that's also part of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think there mm-hmm. is a sense in which people go, oh, you know, they might assume you have money, you know, mm-hmm. you know, or whatnot. Or people see me, I can put things together because I had to learn how to do that, mm-hmm. you know, from a young age mm-hmm. on how to put myself together. Mm-hmm. In ways where I present well.
Yeah. I think projection of African immigrants too. I think that's on the table as well. Yeah. Stereotypes of African immigrants and also real data of particular populations mm-hmm. of African immigrants and affluence and education and all yeah, of, you know, like, the diaspora
yeah,
as well.
We're the outliers. My family's the outliers yeah, for sure. I'm like,
for
you
sure.
know. And I know sure. that was, but maybe it's because my parents came super, super early too. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We also had some significant life circumstances
absolutely.
That completely changed the trajectory, you know, of our lives. But yeah, I think that people probably I came from money or I have because mm-hmm. of those stereotypes or because of the way I present and put myself together. But I've always put myself together since mm-hmm. I was young, probably trying to outlive, you know, yeah. the stereotypes, you know, that were placed on us because of where we
for
live and
sure.
where we came from. You know, and but also I'm a bargain hunter because I grew up. I did not play full price for anything. Yeah, like, you know,
shopping is a sport for some people.
It was a big thing, you know, just trying to really help my mom save money yeah. all the time. That was always yeah. at the forefront of my mind, mm-hmm. you know, as an oldest child and who was yeah. doing a lot of co-parenting, you know. But anyway, but when I think about. Well, actually, you know what? Why don't we take a quick break? Because I do want us to talk even more deeply about children in poverty, child poverty. Why we have these stigmas and why do we not even, why are children that don't even enter onto our radar screen, you know, when it comes, why are they not always top of mind? right. you know, for us when we're talking about, mm-hmm. you know, poverty or talking about anything really, but talking about poverty as yeah. well. So let's take a quick commercial break. And then when we come back, we will be talking about all of the things. So don't go nowhere. Keep it locked.
To our listeners in DC, Maryland, and Virginia, you don't want to miss this opportunity. Join Truth's Table Presents, the Faith and Child Anti-Poverty Forum, this April 4th, 2024. We'll be at the Harriet Tubman Cultural Center in Columbia, Maryland, talking about this important issue of faith and child anti-poverty work. Won't you join us along with our exceptional speakers that will be presenting that day? To learn more about it, go to eventbrite.com. And there you'll find information about Truth's Table Presents Faith and Child Anti-Poverty Forum. We look forward to seeing you on April 4th.
And we are back at the table talking about childhood poverty. First of all, this is an introduction episode, y'all, because this is a series. We cannot do justice to this topic in one episode, as you see.
Yeah.
I'm going back into the recesses of my trunk. I was like, oh, yeah, that happened.
Why?
Because also, that happened. That's probably why I do that now.
You're right. For sure. Welcome. Welcome. I hope you're doing your own work. But as
welcome,
you're
welcome. So, yeah, anyway. Gosh. Okay. We were talking, but what's on the table now that we're back from the commercial break?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think all of us have to reckon with the stereotypes that we have about people who are in poverty.
Yes.
And ideas of deservedness and work ethic mm-hmm. and
rugged individualism.
All of that. All mm-hmm. of that. You know, immigrant mentality, all of these things oh, yeah. are on the table, I think. And also just some self-awareness about our own implicit bias and how we see other people. So, you know, I think that there is a sense in which I know intellectually and at best empathetically that poverty is a condition that can be given and certainly as it relates to children. But I do think there's enough rhetoric. And if I peel back even my own layers, there may be times when I am judgmental or accusatory mm-hmm. of the circumstances that people have or mm-hmm. that found mm-hmm. themselves in. Right. We're mm-hmm. always somebody else's life coach mm-hmm. instead of mm-hmm. coaching ourselves mm-hmm. to what we ought to be. And so have you ever kind of wrestle with maybe your own stereotypes or thoughts or impulses to understanding why someone is poor?
To be, I don't, and I'm not trying to be self-righteous or some, you know, super saint here, but I think because I did not grow up with money, mm-hmm. because I'm not a baller now. Yeah. I had a brief moment in the sun in my early 20s.
Yeah.
Know? I don't know. I don't, I didn't have this, these significant stereotypes of people that were poor because I was in a number, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think in some ways I'm like, I understand the ways in which I know my mom was a hard worker.
Yeah.
It wasn't for a lack of trying, right. you know, it wasn't for a lack of work ethic. You know, it was just, this was the cards mm-hmm. we were dealt, you know, and so I guess in some ways I have a lot of empathy, you know, for people that are poor or that find themselves, you know, at the bottom of the class totem pole, because I know how any of us can easily
or
end
at
up
the
there.
Bottom of the class system.
Class system, you know, mm-hmm. I know how you can easily mm-hmm. end up there. And I know that poverty in this country is engineered. Mm-hmm. as rich as this country is, honestly, nobody should be poor in this country, you know? And so I guess in some ways I really have always seen like, there's forces outside,
yeah.
you know, of us and out mm-hmm. of my family system that, that keep us where we are, you know, yeah. in the class system. And so I didn't have this paternalistic, view of people that mm-hmm. were poor, like, you're lazy or mm-hmm. you're just not doing enough.
Well, I mean, I personally just know too many wealthy people who are lazy. I just know that's not, you know, I mean, that money in and of itself is not about, I mean, you can just simply be born into money. and that's actually most predictive of where you're going to be financially. In so there's life. Not a whole lot of Oprahs.
Yeah. Out here. Mm-hmm. And that's the way the system is designed, right? Yeah. A system of capitalism. And so I don't know. And I also think about the fact that, when it comes to poverty or just money, period, there's a sense in which we can really get mad at the poor as if they should not enjoy good things in life. You know, so there will be critiques about people that were on SNAP, you know, sure. and wanting to get maybe a lobster or maybe right. maybe a steak here and there. Should poor people not enjoy good food?
But I think there's a particular burden because of the shame. Like when you were saying how your mother and you now by, as her child who was shaped by her, are just really conscientious about the way that you steward money, right?
Yeah.
And I think we can look at people with, I think people can have a hypervigilance, right? That they have to they have to present themselves in this kind of overly noble financial way. But I think that's also an internalization of the shame of poverty too, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I expect people are making decisions based on the circumstances that they are in. And if you're not in the circumstance, then it's hard to make a call, right? About what
they ought to be doing. Yeah, or what you would do.
In that circumstance.
Yeah.
There are people, a part of that is, you know, it's rooted in kind of politically in the most recent period of history in the United States, this mythology of the welfare queen and this belief system that there are this disproportionate amount of folks that are
living high on the hog.
Yes, that are lying, that are using food stamps and governmental funds in deceptive ways. Mm-hmm. All this kind of stuff is the narrative, mm-hmm. right? It's the narrative that also parallels the same kind of story, the same kind of political identity that manufactured the narrative of people lying and falsifying votes and dead people voting. These are the same kind of paranoid tropes.
Same camp, yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they work. They're effective. they are very effective tropes about your neighbor, so that you can feel justified in ignoring whatever struggle, whatever pain, whatever hurt that they have, and the way in which you might experience privileges directly as a consequence.
Yeah.
Of the lack that they might have in their lives.
Yeah, and then not to mention the people with power, right. You know, who were taking advantage of the the loans that were given during the pandemic.
Oh, sure. Yeah, government bailout is welfare.
I forgot what the
that's welfare.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. And we paid the price. Yes. And our generation in particular, the millennials have actually absolutely paid the price for that.
For sure.
You know?
For sure.
And so, and just the ways in which they're not, you know, impugned in those same ways. They're not maligned. You know, they're not the subject of scorn, even though these people, I mean, have taken millions upon millions, you know, during the pandemic at a very vulnerable time.
Yeah. You know? And we know that poor people simply, and this is not like we know because it's intuitive. We know this from data that poor communities pay more for whatever they have. Everything. They pay more for food. They pay more for cars. They pay more for loans. They pay more in the long run. Mm-hmm. And so there is a privilege in wealth in the sense that wealth attracts more wealth.
Yes.
And again, that is the power of people being born into a particular economic safety net. We also know that some of the people who have taken the most, biggest and lucrative risk and as entrepreneurs, they have built in safety nets. So it's one thing for somebody to be like, oh, you know, look at what I did. I'm so scrappy. And then you learn that, you know, they had a father who put up 15 million or they had
an inheritance.
These are substantial safety nets, right? So it is easy to so-called take a risk, right? In knowing that if you fall back, you're still going to be falling back on more resources than the average person has in the country. So there is a mythology of the hardworking American that I think fosters pride in people and egotism. Mm-hmm. And at his worst case, lovelessness towards our neighbor. Mm-hmm. Now, I think one, I think because I'm not a descendant of the people who were told that narrative and then they came to America. Like those aren't, you know, so I'm a descendant of the people who built the country, who were force bred to become the free labor force of the country. Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so for me, it's easy to see that that's mythology.
Yeah.
But I do think that there are many people who don't see that as mythology. They've been handed that story and they use it as a point of temporary inspiration to the extent that it seems like it's working out for them until, of course, it does. And then they need somebody to blame. Mm-hmm. Right. And typically people don't blame themselves. They don't blame the capitalistic puppet masters. They blame their poor neighbor. Themselves.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. I think that the danger and the temptation, I think, is for our cousins, you know, to want to play the game the same way. Right. And so to have the same rules of engagement within capitalism, you know, and mm-hmm. begin to imbibe that, well, you know, I got this, you know, yeah. if I just work harder, yeah. if I just do this or if they do make it, whatever make mm-hmm. it is to them.
Yeah. It's the survival of the fittest notions, which are clearly from the pit of hell.
I mean, absolutely. Like
that is such an un-Christian way of thinking about it is anything.
You know, because capitalism destroys collectivism, you know, and so you thinking that you got it on your own, you know, you got it out of the mud by yourself. It was me and mine.
Mythology.
That mentality,
it's all mythology. Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, and the standard, you know, for success, the standard for financial liberty, let me call it that way, you know, is not white men and it's not capitalism. Mm-hmm. These are not the systems by which we want to be comparing ourselves.
Right.
Okay.
These
are the very systems that bound our people.
Yeah.
You know, continue to bind. Our salvation is not found in capitalism. It's not found in our capital. It's not found in our bank account. It's not. Because it's here today, gone tomorrow. You know, and the scriptures talk about that all the time. You know, how the money just comes in and it can just fly away. It can fly away. Literally. I think that's the language that
literally fly away.
It can fly away.
Totally.
You know, and we just keep on living. Keep on living, as the old saints say.
Right.
You have not experienced that. But seriously, I think, and we have got to find a way, you know, for some of our cousins who I love, but I'm like, y'all, black capitalism is not the answer. It's just not. I understand why, you know, people feel that, you know, I think there's an issue of agency there, you know, and feeling like if I could just, you know, then I will get in an oppressive system, like, where money is king.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and what also is like, if you can't turn over the system.
Yeah. Can't beat them, join them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think throughout history, there have been, you know, intellectuals who debate that back and forth. And there are some people who engage that system knowing well that it is mythology, knowing that it's problematic, but they're just trying to kind of hook it and work it as best they can, right? And then there are others who actually, you know, they buy it. They believe it. Like they're true believers.
Yeah.
And I think
and
it's important. Right. I think it's important for us to reckon with where we may live within that, right?
Yeah.
Where all people within the system that we're in, how we show up in that, right? Because even if we don't like the capitalistic system and we can critique it, you know, all day. And I was trained in an academic program where we spent a many of classes having a good time tearing it down. And then graduated people who immediately went and got MBAs created, you know, what they needed to create. Right.
Yeah.
I think that we just need to know with eyes wide open what role we're playing in that system.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That has been handed to us, that we have been born into, right?
Exactly.
So I do think it's wise when people understand money. I think you could be a person who is sociologically critiquing and theologically critiquing greed and capitalism and economic injustice and all those things. And I think a part of your critique has to be rooted in understanding how this thing works.
And where you fall into it.
Yes, right, absolutely.
Know, how much do you consume? How much are you
taking?
What do you, you know, and I think you have to think about that. I think that's something we've put on the table a little bit too, but yeah, what does it mean? I just don't know that. I don't know. We have to be, I think we all, and it's something I think for all of us to think about, is the ways that capitalism has shaped us and misshaped us, you know, in the church outside the church, obviously, but inside the church.
Oh, for sure.
You know, as believers, yeah. when you know, how have we begun to really be misshaped by this thing?
Yeah.
You know, and this, mm-hmm. this mammon, yeah. you know, the love of mammon, like in what ways? Mm-hmm. I think we have to do a lot of self-interrogation, yeah. you know, about that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something worth talking about and worth wrestling with and thinking about.
Yeah.
As we continue in, you know, into the series, you know, yeah. but we even talked about the in one of the earlier episodes about fast fashion.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, and what's behind that,
for
you know,
sure.
And getting those threads,
accumulation.
You know, at a ridiculously low price.
Well, and even when we think about the caricatures that are shaped about people who are the working poor, who are experiencing poverty, mm-hmm. Those characters usually vilify their work ethic, their temperament, their ethics, their morals.
Their family systems.
Mm-hmm. And we know that is wrong. But even if you were a person who is intoxicated with that mythology, you're going to accept it and embrace it. What then do you say to the children of the working poor? What do you say to the one-year-old who yeah. is living in a neighborhood where there is still all kinds of toxin in the paints in the wall that impact their frontal lobe development? What do you say to the three-year-old who it is not their fault that there is a sleep impoverishment, which is associated with poverty, that impacts their ability to rest and be in a hole where there's absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you say to the seven-year-old who didn't choose the school that they go to? So even if you want to cling to what I think are these ungodly caricatures of our neighbors, what are you saying about the children's work ethic?
Yeah.
What must we do, and how must we respond to children who are facing poverty?
Who are suffering in some very significant ways.
Absolutely.
You know, the children that are having to fight off rats and collecting roaches because there's so many of them in
yeah.
the apartment.
And well, and it's a direct connection to things like asthma. So there's so many, yeah. there's so many indignities.
Much contempt.
The caricatures mm-hmm. do not hold up. It's wrong to say that about the 18-year-old, the 28-year-old, the 38-year-old, but you can see just how misguided it is.
Yes.
To then accuse the baby, the toddler, the elementary school kid, the high school kid, of being the reason for the poverty that they were born into. Yeah. And as Christians, and we'll explore this more in our series, we are called to respond empathetically and to never forget that we are products of grace. So we are not in a position.
Yeah.
because we are a needy people by design.
Yes.
Christians are needy by design, or we may not be Christians at mm-hmm, all. Mm-hmm. So I look forward to exploring this conversation more.
Absolutely. So we'll see y'all at the next Truth Table. Bye.